Here we are, Lawyer Talk, off the record, on the air, another edition of They Don't Teach You That in Law School. I got Troy here. Troy Hendrickson works with me up in the law firm Palmer Legal Defense. And what we cover here are basically topics that Troy is learning about in law school, stuff that we then deal with up in the real world and like street law that we do up there, criminal defense, and then try to take that even beyond that. So it's not, you don't have to be a law student to enjoy this. In fact, I think we're getting a lot of great feedback of folks who aren't even law students.
Yeah.
Although I just got a comment from somebody out in Pittsburgh that was listening, or in, I think Duquesne, that's out in Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, it's in Pittsburgh, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Shows you how stupid we are. We cover various topics, and today we happen to be working on a case, and you asked me about this. You know, what happens is Troy will come in the morning from when we do these. I was wondering about why this is going on.
So it just keeps me up at night. I'm just fascinated.
Yeah,
I'm just tossing and turning. I'm like, what,
right.
What is the answer?
We'll get you an internship with Dershowitz next.
So the question was, we have a crime where the victim doesn't want to come forward, doesn't want to testify, whatever, doesn't really want the case prosecuted, but the state is still prosecuting it.
Right.
And so in my head, I'm not saying it's a victimless crime. However, if the victim doesn't want to do it, why does the state now have the power to just say, well, we're still going to prosecute them? That's where I was.
Right. I hear terms like this all the time, or comments like this. Well, the state's picking it up. We hear that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sort of common public vernacular, but it's not really accurate. I mean, the state is always picking it up if it's a crime. So let's start with that. Who are the parties in the lawsuit? Because a criminal prosecution is really just a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And in Ohio, it would be the state of Ohio versus John Doe, who's accused of the crime. If I sue you, it would be Steve Palmer, plaintiff, versus Troy Hendrickson, defendant, in a civil case. So that's all it is. We're talking about the parties. And every time you have a crime, it's always the governmental entity, whether it's the U.S. government, the state of Ohio, a mayor's court, or whatever town or city you live in, it'll be that entity versus the individual, or sometimes even a corporation. Corporations can be charged with crimes. So it, you know, if you look at it from that perspective, it starts to make a lot more sense. Then it becomes about the evidence, and there's more nuance. We'll dive into it. But if the state is the plaintiff and they're trying to prove a crime against, say, you, the state needs evidence. A lot of times into the mix is a victim. And, you know, we have victimless crimes. We were just talking about one off the air here, but in the mix, we have a victim. The victim is often the key evidence in the case. So if it's an assault, like the one we're working on, the person who is assaulted is going to supply the best evidence against the defendant. And now the question is, can the state prosecute the case even if the victim doesn't show up at court or doesn't want to prosecute or isn't interested at all? And that's sort of the scenario you're talking about.
Yeah. And I understand that you're saying there's just two parties. How I view it is there is the main two parties, but then there's this little third party that is evidence, like you're saying. However, victims, I feel like are still technically a party of it. I mean, we've Marcy's Law or whatever, and I think they should have some type of say. But I do see what you're saying, that the best evidence that they could have is the victim.
Mm-hmm.
But if they have enough evidence without the victim, then
yeah, no,
great, I guess screw it. But
great point. We'll talk about the evidence issues and whether the prosecutor or the state rather can prove their case. But you brought up Marcy's Law. In Ohio, we have a constitutional amendment that it's a victims' rights amendment, and this is one of those things that always sounds awesome until it's actually implemented, and then there's some problems in the weeds. In general, we all like the idea that victims should be vindicated. They should have a say so in what happens. And that's a very popular position. But sometimes it doesn't always go as the way the legislature or the voters wanted. This is one of those cases. So if it is true that we are going to give victims rights and say so in a courtroom, and what's happened is there's a huge push where prosecutors actually now anymore in modern times, and this shift has happened in my career over the last 29 years and change. Prosecutors now have to actually give notice to victims so the victims can show up in court and be heard. Most prosecutors will sort of push off decision, and I say this with all due respect, but they push off decision-making to victims where they'll tell me, look, I have to talk to my victims to see what they want. And I'm thinking to myself, well, wait a minute, aren't you the state of Ohio? and this is just a witness? Well, no, now they're victims. We've elevated victims to a different status. Here is the dubious, here's where things get a little bit turned on their ear. What if the victim doesn't want to prosecute? Then we're going to hear something like, well, we don't have to do what the victim wants. Now, if the victim, so it's like one of these things.
It's where, like a little switch where they can turn it on and off. They're like, oh,
we will do whatever the victim wants as long as it's what we want.
Okay.
And then we will not only do that, we will rely on victims' input to make decisions and justify our decisions unless it's not what we want. And meaning unless it's not to prosecute. So it's sort of like those in favor of free speech. Well, look, I love freedom. I love free speech, unless you don't agree with me. And then, you know, we should curtail that speech. And that's going on politically. But it's like that happens. And this is where you got to be careful. So if you're going to give, if the victims truly will have rights, then shouldn't I ask rhetorically the state respect when a victim doesn't want to prosecute? Now, there's a, what's the counter argument to that? So you asked me about something.
Yeah.
You asked me about.
I think that the counter argument.
You asked me about a syndrome recently.
Yes, yes. I think we were talking about like beaten women's syndrome. Is that
battered women's
battered
syndrome.
Battered women's syndrome. Yeah. And the prosecutor would make the argument, well, she doesn't know what she actually needs. Like she's.
Yeah, we know better.
Yeah, we know better.
The state knows better. Now, that's a scary thought, frankly.
Yes.
But we know better.
And, you know, they could bring in experts and all that and say, like, hey, we're doing what's best for the victim. Like, we're trying to do the good thing here. So we're just not going to listen to the victim.
So now it's time for my typical obscure movie drop. There was a movie called The Burning Bed, made for TV, if I'm not mistaken, back in maybe, I'm guessing 78, 70, maybe 80, I don't know. Farrah Fawcett, I think, played a battered woman who is based on a true story, I think, but she played a battered woman. She had been, her abusive husband or boyfriend had been physically and mentally abusing her for years. Finally, enough was enough. He beat her up and she waited till he fell asleep and lit the bed on fire, left the house with the kids and killed him. And, you know, the question is whether that was an act of self-defense based on this sort of hangover effect of all the abuse over the years. And, you know, I'm not going to go into detail about whether that's right or wrong, but there is something like battered women's syndrome. And prosecutors will say, and look, I mean, this victim is so, maybe call it like Stockholm syndrome. I don't know if you know what that is, but is just so subject to this abuse that is, he or she have been accustomed to it and now will not prosecute on their own. So we need to step in and take over that role. We know better. Again, that's a scary thought, but that's the argument for it. And like anything in law, it all depends. And there's never any sure right answer, but you know,
feel like that'd be like a case by case basis. Like, I'd want to know the amount of years, like living together, like the amount of events, like it, you can't just automatically say because there was an abusive relationship, it's automatically better woman.
Of course not. And there's law, at least in Ohio, and I imagine elsewhere, there's law that says in order to establish something like battered women's syndrome, you have to have an expert. There's got to be an expert psychologist who's going to come in and say, yeah, I did an analysis. We ran these tests. We administered the blank, 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 blank. And this person scored whatever, and I think that she qualifies or he qualifies as a battered victim, and therefore this. The prosecutor can't just say it. Now, but what we're talking about is really before that, the prosecutor's making decisions on whether to prosecute the case on behalf of, say, the state of Ohio.
Yeah.
And that's what we're dealing with upstairs right now, or at least that's the question.
Yeah.
Can the state prosecute when the alleged victim of a crime doesn't want to pursue it? The answer is yes, categorically yes. It seems contrary, though. This is where I always get a little heartburn. And it's not political. I
got some Tums, if you need that.
You got some Tums. It's always giving me a little heartburn. Because you get the state saying, all right, we're gonna ride Marcy's law to the dirt if this victim wants to prosecute. And we're going to ask for max sentences if this victim wants that. And we're not only going to go to trial and not offer a plea resolution, even though we think we might lose the trial because that's what the victim wants, because they really want that conviction. But if it's reversed, they won't do that. And I'm not saying I'm not impugning all prosecutors. There's lots of good ones, but I run into this quite a bit. And I even do some representation of alleged victims, and I've been on both sides. So under Marcy's law here in Ohio, victims have a right to a lawyer. And if I show up in court and tell a prosecutor, look, I'm representing the defendant's best friend or defendant's cousin. A lot of times cousins, brothers get in fights over Thanksgiving or something. I've had a few of those. This person doesn't want to prosecute. They got drunk. Somebody lit the deck on fire because they were frying their turkey and it got out of hand. And somebody called somebody an asshole. And next thing you know, there's a fisticuffs in the backyard. And they don't want to prosecute it. The prosecutor says, sorry, Charlie, we're going to do it anyway. And it sort of irks me because I think if it were the opposite, that the evidence was crappy and the prosecutor didn't want to prosecute it, but the victim says do it, they would do it. So there's a double standard, I guess, is really the problem. So
let's say the prosecutor
Look, I'm not impugning all you people. So this is going to get cut it out and say, he's saying that. I'm not. I'm just saying that's, I run into that. And if you don't think I do, then you're not being intellectually honest.
So let's say the prosecutor goes to the victim's family and goes to the victim and is like, hey, they want to do a plea deal. Are you okay with 5 years instead of the max 10? I'm just making up numbers here. And they're like, no, we want the max. And the prosecutor turns around and still does the 5-year plea deal.
It happens.
Can the family appeal?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet, but they're going to come into court and start banging the table, and they have a right to be at court and say, we don't agree with this. Mm-hmm. And the prosecutor is then going to have to say, well, I'm doing it for a reason, for evidentiary reasons. And this is why we have, I think the danger of this is when taken to its extreme, we end up placing prosecution in the hands of interested parties. And I'm not diminishing what it's like to be a victim of a crime. It's horrible. I've been a victim of a crime, and it's not that. But as Abe Lincoln famously said, he who represents himself as a fool for a lawyer, and it's not unlike that here. We don't want victims prosecuting the crimes. Then we get, in fact, we had a comment on one of our other episodes, an eye for an eye. It starts to reduce to that. And there's a reason we want to run it through the state's filter. Prosecutors know cases that they can prove and not prove. They know what is right and wrong most of the time. But the more we inject these other interests into it, we are creating generation after generation after generation of prosecutors who don't do that stuff. They've never had to evaluate a case independently of what a victim wants. And again, I'm not criticizing. It's just, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. And prosecutors should have independent discretion to make decisions. And good prosecutors will do this. Good prosecutors will say, look, and I've heard them say it in chambers with judges, look, judge, I need to have a meeting with my victims and explain to them the problems with the case. And I'm just going to tell them that I can't prove the case. But all too often, maybe the opposite happens, where the victim is saying, look, 5 years is good enough. And the prosecutor is saying, why don't we, I think 8's probably better. I think this case is worth 8. All right, well, if that's what you say. You can just see it. You can just see it going in that direction. And that's where the danger is. So like all things, like all government policies and practices, it can go in an unexpected direction. And we might get unintended consequences. Now, there's some evidentiary issues, I think was what we were getting at. Let's say the victim doesn't show up or doesn't want to prosecute and says, I'm not cooperating. In fact, we had a case, we did an appeal recently where one of the victims just got on the stand and said, I'm not testifying, I'm taking the Fifth.
Yeah.
And, all right, so can the prosecutor still prove the case? Maybe. Here's where it gets interesting, because we're almost shifting into a whole nother topic. We'll just do it anyway. Here's where it gets interesting, because look, everybody who's watched Matlock, Murder, She Wrote, probably Suits now is another big lawyer show.
Suits is the big one that everybody watches now. They actually just like reboot it with like LA version. So like Suits, New York was the one that everybody watched, and now they're doing it again. I think I watched the original Suits like live. My mom made me, I was a kid, so I dabbled with it.
So look, I remember Perry Mason reruns, and then Matlock and was the modern Perry Mason. And Perry Mason and Matlock, there's always this famous moment where during the thundering cross-examination by the defense lawyer, whether it be Perry Mason or Matlock, somebody said, oh, you're right. It was actually me. I did it. Or, you get, in fact, my former partner, Eric Yavich, God rest his soul, we used to call it a Matlock. If you get the victim to basically recant on the witness stand, we'd call it a Matlock. And he got one. I've never had one exactly like that, but he got one time. No, you're right. I actually don't, I can't recognize this guy. So you know,
that'd be amazing.
It was a Matlock.
I imagine the jury was like, wow.
And everybody's thinking, what does this have to do with victims' rights and somebody showing? But here's the thing. If I'm being prosecuted as a defendant for a crime and the person who's accusing me of the crime is not in court, I don't get to have a Matlock moment. I don't get to ask that person questions. I don't get to cross-examine that person. I don't get to confront that person. Any government, you're a government scholar.
Confrontation clause.
Confrontation clause of the Sixth Amendment. I wasn't going to put you on the spot and see if you knew the Sixth Amendment. So the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution guarantees, among other things, your right of confrontation. Also trial by jury and counsel. But anyway, your right of confrontation is I get to confront my accusers. That is interpreted as I get to question my accusers, the witnesses against me in a courtroom, and my lawyer gets to ask leading probing questions. Why, pray tell, would we need such a thing?
Isn't it like because back in the day, common law, like England, they would have just accused you of crimes and you couldn't even like confront them. Like it was just, hey, here's what you're accused of. You're guilty.
Well, yeah, because we can't trust the government. And,
yeah.
You know, look, we don't trust the government. And anybody who does, then think twice. Because, look, the government is made up of people, and people are made up of our own inherent flawed human characteristics, whether you believe in that biblically or whether you just can watch it. Like, we are all flawed. We all have this thing called ego. We all have this thing called self, and we have this self-interest. And prosecutors are no different. I wouldn't expect we put a lot on prosecutors to go into a courtroom and actually say, my job is to do justice. I'm going to do what's right. But I'm going to have to do what's right in the context of this fight, this adversarial fight, which sometimes, if you take it to its logical extreme at times, it means they have to give up. They can't shoot all the bullets in their gun. I mean that metaphorically. They can't use every tool at their disposal because their job is to do justice and protect the defendant's rights. And I even had a federal case where a federal judge was saying, well, this is going to violate the government's due process rights. And I went ballistic. The government didn't have any due process rights. We do. Like, the Constitution doesn't protect the government from us. It's the opposite. And that's why we have something called confrontation. And the U.S. Supreme Court, I should look up the case, but the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about confrontation for years since the founding of our country. And they have said, it's almost an exact quote, but I'll see if I can get it right. Cross-examination is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of the truth. Meaning, we can't trust the government, nor should we. Doesn't mean they're bad. Doesn't mean prosecutors are bad. But we recognize inherently as a system that we can't trust the government to present both sides of a case. So we have to give the defendant the ability and protect the defendant's ability to present his side of the case. That means confrontation. I get to ask that witness on the stand, yeah, but you didn't see this. And you, like, think Cousin Vinny, my Cousin Vinny. Your glasses needed an update. This was too far away and you couldn't see.
His girlfriend is the expert witness too.
I think she's awesome. My Cousin Vinny's awesome. Look, I mean, there's lots of stuff that's unrealistic, but it is awesome. It's a great lesson in trial lawyering and the right of confrontation. It also is a great lesson in another right that we have, which is called the right to compulsory process. We also incumbent in our rights under the Sixth Amendment is to actually subpoena witnesses to come testify for us. So in My Cousin Vinny, they bring in the expert who happens to be his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right. She's very well qualified, though. She did a great job.
Right. She was great. We'll do a breakdown of that. But anyway, the point is that when the prosecutor or the state is choosing to go forward on a case without a victim, I don't have a right of confrontation. Now, that doesn't automatically render the case void automatically say that I win as a defendant, but it definitely creates some problems. And
your main evidence is it's gone now. Well, it's not gone. It's a lot harder to use it now. They got to find a way to.
They have to prove the case without the victim. Now let's talk about ways they can do that. So okay. We don't have a victim coming into a courtroom and saying, Troy did this to me. He followed me in my car and whacked me with his tire iron because he wanted to steal my wallet. And I recognized Troy. So you don't want to prosecute because you knew I was just joking or whatever it was, or you knew he was just.
Yeah.
So you're not going to prosecute. You're not showing up in court or whatever. Maybe you're just, they couldn't find you. How does the state prove its case? Well, maybe there's witnesses. So if there's a witness that says, I saw this happen and I recognize that guy and that was him and he did it, fair enough. Mm-hmm. The prosecutor's not relying on what you say. They're relying on what somebody else says, and I get to cross-examine that person. Say there's a video evidence or video surveillance camera that picked it up and it's on tape. Same thing. I can challenge. I can dispute. I can call experts to say that's not accurate. I can challenge that video. But let's say none of those things exist. And the prosecutor wants to prove the case based on what the victim says, what the accuser actually said out of court. Accuser calls 911 and says, man, I know him. He's my best friend. He just whacked me on the head with a tire iron, stole my wallet. His name is Steve Palmer. Just perfect description. This is who he is. And now that person changes his mind or maybe isn't available and doesn't testify. In my trial, I don't get to cross-examine that statement. I don't have a witness there to cross-examine. That's where problems arise. How's it resolve?
I think how it resolves is they just have a lot weaker case. I mean, there is exceptions to try and get their statements and everything in. I mean, that's what we're going through upstairs right now. But I mean,
all right. So you're really bringing up two separate things. One, the case against the defendant is a lot weaker. I mean, the jury's going to have to decide the case without the testimony of the star.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason the star's not there is going to be important. And it may not be what everybody thinks. Just because the witness, like, you get a battered woman who doesn't come to court, and the jury is going to, I think, you know, juries are smart. They're going to catch wind of that, and they're going to say, yeah, it makes sense. She's not coming to court because this guy's doing this day in and day out.
Yeah.
So we don't care that she's not here. In fact, we feel worse for her that she's not here, and we're going to be more likely to convict. But maybe in another scenario, it might be that, all right, well, this alleged victim.
Is the prosecutor just allowed to say, of course the victim didn't show up?
Not without evidence. And it's got to be relevant. So sometimes not, you know. The defense would have to be careful not to open the door to that, but meaning bring up something that would permit the prosecutor to refute our argument. So, you know, if the victim's not there, a jury, but they're going to get the hint, right? In a domestic violence case, the jury's going to think, well, of course she doesn't want to be here, because that's the trope. They're battered. They don't want to prosecute. They have been overcome by this constant abuse. But there might be a flip scenario where it's not so clear. And the jury may think on a different scenario that, boy, if this guy in this case doesn't have the wherewithal to actually come in, that's too weak for us. So there still has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt is what you're getting at. And the jury has to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. And just because there's evidence of it doesn't mean they have to believe it. They may want more evidence to be firmly convinced. But there's another issue, and that's the confrontation issue. And can the court even admit the statements without the witness testifying? And this is where the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't know, starting with a case called Crawford v. Washington back in 2008-ish.
Sounds about right. I've read it a lot.
They said, look, hearsay. So everybody knows what hearsay is. Everybody thinks they knows what hearsay is. They think they know what hearsay is. Not a court statement that is offered to prove what the statement says. So, you know, this is the guy who did it. So the prosecutor is going to offer that statement. And since we don't have a witness actually saying it, it's made out of court. It's hearsay. It's hearsay whether the witness shows up or not. But if the witness doesn't show up, and not only is it hearsay, I don't get to cross-examine that person. So now we have a hearsay problem. So there has to be an exception. There are lots of them, as you're learning.
Yeah.
Like a statement for medical diagnosis or treatment. Out-of-court statement. If the person is making that statement to doctors to get treatment, well, it's coming. It's not hearsay. Excited utterances. Present sense impression. There's lots of them. We won't go into them. But assume there's one that exists. Now it's hearsay, but it's coming into evidence. I still don't get to cross-examine it. And the U.S. Supreme Court is sort of slowly over the years honing in on this issue and reviving a defendant's right of confrontation in that scenario. So it gets really dicey for the prosecutor about whether the state, can pursue a case based solely on hearsay evidence by a victim who's not, or a witness who's not testifying in court.
So the state has to go over two speed bumps. The first one, they have to get over the hearsay issue.
Has to get in first, right?
Yep. And the next speed bump is it a confrontation clause issue?
Yep.
If they can get over both those speed bumps.
So what they don't teach you, you're exactly right. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. Call them speed bumps. They're hurdles. Mm. And what they don't always teach you in law school is this. And I learned this early on. if I'm in a courtroom and you hear objection, hearsay, I always, even before Crawford v. Washington, I always would say, objection, hearsay also violates my client's right of confrontation. Because immediately, and that wasn't always obvious back in the day, because in the old law before Crawford, it just says, well, as long as it's a firmly rooted hearsay exception, doesn't matter. But
that's,
I always said
that's kind of crazy. That's how it was? Mm-hmm. You just, wow.
Yep. Didn't violate confrontation. But I learned from an old war horse who was an expert in federal and state evidence for the better part of his life, still alive, my father, who was an evidence professor. I learned evidence at the dinner table. And every time you object on hearsay, you also say confrontation. I don't care if the witness is there or not. I still say confrontation. Judge is gonna, why? Because it's a habit. Judge is going to say, well, the guy testified. You can cross-examine. I don't care. It's still confrontation because I say so. Deny my objection if you must. Because I'd rather have the objection and be wrong than not have the objection and be wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, whoever does the appeal will appreciate it. That's for right. Sure.
So anyway, a great question. Because you're learning about hearsay in law school. What they're not teaching you is that these rules that you're learning have real life applicability. In fact, I think your teacher even said, well, you'll never use medical diagnosis or treatment statements in real life. I do it every day.
Yeah.
Because victims of crime go to the doctor and they say, doc, this guy punched me and broke my orbital socket. And here's the medical treatment I got. And the doc's going to say, what happened? And the person, the victim is going to say, well, I was at a bar and I was walking to my car and somebody out of nowhere came up and socked me in the eye and broke my orbital socket. Are those statements, are the facts behind that for the purpose of medical diagnosis or treatment? You might be surprised how broad that goes, but maybe. And so those statements are now, they could form the sole basis for the prosecution or at least corroboration of what somebody says on the witness stand. So it is a critical exception.
We need to do like a whole episode on this whole medical exception and the confrontation
issue. I should teach hearsay right here.
We just need to do primary purpose episode. That's what needs to happen. Like it just needs to.
I still talk at seminars and sort of teach. There's evidence that you learn in class, and then there's trial evidence, and they're totally different animals. Now the thing is though, you have to master the rules first. Become a master of the rules and understand the academics, and then you get to do the fun stuff. Like how do you apply those rules? How do you get creative? Where are the snakes in the grass? But anyway, that's a whole different episode, but great topic. And if you folks have a topic you want us to cover, maybe you're a law student, because I know that we have growing, it's like we got the law school army is starting to follow us. but if you're in law school, you want us to cover something that they don't teach you in law school, or you think maybe we're learning upstairs, or that you were covering upstairs in the law practice, or you just want some real world insight into it, I'll give it to you. I'm not always right, but I try to be. Just shoot us a comment, lawyertalkpodcast.com. Shoot us a question there, comment in the socials, and we'll get to it. But until then, this is Lawyer Talk off the record, on the air. They don't teach you that in law school style. Till next week. By the way, we're sponsored by Circle 270 Media. Phenomenal. If you've got a podcast that you want, if you're in the Central Ohio area, even nationally, great podcast consultant, check out Circle 270 Media. Brett over there will take care of you.